for January do February 1st. I burned the highest ever, 140 gallons, and that's $735.
The reality of trying to make ends meet in rural Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, February 23rd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Senator Lisa Murkowski gets mad about old exploratory wells in the NPRA that need cleaning up.
Well, you want an action plan, let's raise hell. I mean, this is just wrong. It's just wrong.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Timing is everything. A mother who waits until her child is at least 2 years old before becoming pregnant again has a better chance of regaining strength and energy between pregnancies. Her baby is more likely to be born on time and at a good weight. So talk to your health care provider to find out how to plan your pregnancies and ask for the state's free birth spacing booklet. Take the time to build a strong and healthy family. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Emails released by Alaska state officials show that Sarah Palin's final months in office saw her fighting for a signature natural gas pipeline project and frustrated over a series of ethics complaints. In a June 4, 2009 email to an aide, Palin told her to push hard to get a gas line. In another June 2009 email to Lieutenant Governor Sean Parnell, she said ethics complaints waste her time and money and the state's time and money. Citizens and news organizations, including the Associated Press, first requested Palin's emails in September 2008 as part of her vetting as the Republican vice presidential nominee. The state released a batch of the emails last June. Nearly 35,000 pages of emails were released today, generally from October 2008 until Palin's resignation in July 2009. U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski touched on an array of federal issues that affect Alaskans in her annual speech to the state legislature today. In her brief remarks, which lasted less than 20 minutes, Murkowski spoke chiefly of the need to increase oil and gas development and the role Alaska plays in national military strategy. She said there's an urgent need for new production to fill the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, noting that Congressman Don Young has now succeeded a dozen times in moving legislation through the House of Representatives to open the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to oil drilling. Murkowski said she thinks she has enough votes to get ANWR through the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committees, but it won't go anywhere in the full Senate until there's a filibuster-proof 60 votes and a supportive administration. However, she promised to keep working on it.
I will not give up until it succeeds. It must happen. It is simply too important to this state. It's too important to this nation.
Murkowski said another priority is making sure the nation's leaders understand Alaska's role in national security. She said she's skeptical of a proposal to move an F-16 squadron from Eielson Air Force Base near Fairbanks to Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson in Anchorage. A federal commission recommended against the move in 2005, and Murkowski says it's still a bad idea.
We shouldn't pit Eielson versus Elmendorf or Jay Bear versus Jay Park. We need to focus our energy on the long-term vision of Alaska's role in the global force structure.
The senator did not limit her interest in energy to the national subjects, such as ANWR or the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. She also recognized that the state has its own in-state energy problems, calling it the most critical issue involving the state's future success. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
During the question and answer part of Senator Murkowski's appearance before the joint session, Bethel Senator Lyman Hoffman told her that in some parts of the state, heating oil costs have gone up 24%, while heating degree days have increased by 22% all this year. He told her he'd heard of people paying $150 for 20 gallons of heating fuel.
That's a double whammy to the citizens of Alaska. Many of them are facing the fact that they're spending over 40% of their disposable income on energy.
Murkowski said Alaska's internal fuel supply, along with its cost, is the top issue for the state's families and businesses. She has seen retail stores in small communities with energy bills of more than $10,000 a month. She said it affects the military presence in the state, transportation projects, even North Slope development. It's a part of the high cost of doing anything in Alaska.
This is our Achilles heel. Energy is our Achilles heel, and if we fail to be more aggressive in how we help our communities, our communities have no choice. I mean, we're seeing people moving in from the villages in your area particularly, Senator Hoffman. They're coming to town because they can't afford to live where they were born and where their parents were born.
Murkowski says the cost of fuel on the national level is helping Alaska by bringing more attention to the problem in Washington, D.C. She said the nation is now paying for short-term decisions made more than a decade ago. As an example, decisions on ANWR.
The issue that we face in the Congress is, what can we do today to make a difference? And I think we need to stop framing it in the what can we do today to make a difference today. It's what can we do today to make a difference tomorrow.
As for steps the state can take on its own to meet some of its energy needs, Murkowski told reporters following the speech that she's optimistic some of the plans will come together. She said right now, the problem is that there are too many options on the table.
This is a dilemma for us as a state, and I think we've known it for a long, long time. It's not about our ability to do it because of lack of resource. It is failure to coalesce around one idea. Other states don't have any options at all. I suppose we could be in a worse situation.
Murkowski invited the legislature to take the opportunity to make more of an impact on national issues, to tell her office about their concerns. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
Senator Murkowski was also asked about two messages to the federal government that are pending action in the state legislature this session. A resolution by Anchorage Republican Cherise Millett asks the Department of the Interior and the Bureau of Land Management to clean up 137 abandoned oil wells drilled for exploration within the National Petroleum Reserve. The wells were part of government-sponsored NPRA exploration between 1942 and 1982 and have never been plugged or subject to remediation. Leaving them as they are is a violation of state and federal law. Murkowski said that is offensive.
Well, you want an action plan? Let's raise hell. I mean, this is just wrong. It's just wrong. And they just can't handle the fact that they have turned their head to the responsibility. And yet, as you point out, they won't let you walk anywhere up there without 16 permits. And yet they have failed in their environmental stewardship in a way that is so egregious.
She told Millett that 7 of the wells have been cleaned. The next 37 wells on the federal list would cost only $50 million to close, but the Interior Department refuses to work on more than one per year. Another resolution pending in the House is by Anchorage Democrat Les Guerra that calls for a constitutional amendment to prevent corporations or unions from being able to make unlimited contributions to political campaigns. That was the result of the U.S. Supreme Court's now famous Citizens United decision that allows private money into the process without having that source of money identified. Murkowski said that decision has led to a phenomenal impact on this year's elections and is counter to the idea of transparent government.
For lots of different reasons, people don't like to disclose. Well, for lots of good reasons, we need to disclose. So here's where I am on Citizens United. If we can figure out a way that legislatively we can require greater disclosure, we need to do that, and we need to do it soon.
Murkowski pointed out that she was the beneficiary of a super PAC support in the 2010 election. However, she said the principal supporters of all such groups should be made public. However, she doesn't expect any federal action until after this year's campaigns are over. Millett's resolution on what's called the legacy wells is in the Rules Committee and could be on the House floor at any time. Guerra's resolution on Citizens United is in the House Judiciary Committee. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, what do Alaskans do with a frozen waterfall? They climb it.
Later on today, we're going to do mock leads where we're on the ice and going from the ground up.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Alaska Budget Report, providing in-depth coverage for state government since 1991, on the web at akbudgetreport.com.
You can find APRN headlines and more online at alaskapublic.org. Local, national, and international news, upcoming events, and statewide community conversation. AlaskaPublic.org, connecting you to Alaska, one story at a time.
Whenever oil prices are high, the effect is immediately felt in rural Alaska. Prices for everything from groceries to building materials go up because they are all shipped in by fuel-run planes or barges. As KYUK's Angela Denning Barnes reports from Bethel, residents are having trouble budgeting to stay warm as well.
With 6,000 residents, Bethel is the largest community in Western Alaska. One might think that being a hub community, prices might not be so bad, until you ask residents about their heating bills.
It's averaging about $850 a month.
That's Bob Ngayek, and like most Bethel residents, he relies on heating fuel. The fuel, which is brought in on a barge every summer, is running $6.25 a gallon. Over the past few months, Ngayek says he's used about 120 gallons of heating fuel per month. The record cold January didn't help, with temperatures averaging 17 below zero. So how does Ngayek budget for $850 heating bills?
Very, very difficult. You know, we're dipping into our savings and credit cards and stuff like that just to get past through this winter. And it's going to be like this for another 2-3 months.
Ngayek says he's not alone. A lot of people he knows are struggling.
Heating fuel bill is almost, for an average person, probably about half of your paycheck a month.
For January due February 1st, I burned the highest ever 140 gallons, and that's $735.
Karen Fredericks is another Bethel resident. Her bill would have been higher than $735 if it wasn't subsidized. She lives in a three-bedroom house through the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. Instead of paying $6.25 a gallon for heating fuel, she pays $5.25. Working part-time, though, she says she can't make it on her own, so she often relies on her 19-year-old son, who also works.
Get help from family members, mainly my kid, and it's tough.
For the month of December, Frederick's bill was $585. She says they try to keep their thermostat set low, but there are problems with that, too.
We're thinking, okay, if we keep it at 60 degrees or 62 degrees, maybe we'll burn less fuel. But with the pipes freezing, you know, we have to keep it at a certain temperature at home. And the furnace, during the cold spell, when it had 55 below wind chill, every half an hour the furnace was coming on.
Rural lawmakers have heard many stories like these from their constituents and are increasing efforts to find solutions. One of those is Senate Bill 203, which is sponsored by Fairbanks Senator Joe Thomas and a lot of rural senators. It would establish an energy voucher for all adult PFD recipients in the state. Representative Bryce Edgman of Dillingham supports it, saying the state's estimated $4 billion in surplus should be shared.
While we have surplus dollars down here, I think it's incumbent upon us to do everything we can to try to get some relief to our people back home.
Southwest Alaska Senator Lyman Hoffman of Bethel is one of 8 co-sponsors of the bill. He says there should be a lot of support in the Senate for passage.
The prospects of us passing the legislation is very, very high, but I would say that it would have a better chance if we could get action on it on the House side.
Hoffman says a key component of the Senate's legislation is that it seeks long-term energy planning by requiring the administration to review the voucher program and come up with a more permanent plan. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
A new laboratory at the University of Alaska Fairbanks enables realistic testing of power generation systems for Alaska villages. Alaska Center for Energy and Power Director Gwen Holdman says the 5,000-square-foot lab can analyze both traditional diesel and alternative energy generation systems.
Doing that in a laboratory in a very well-instrumented setting really allows us to figure out ways to optimize power generation, both standard diesel power as well as integrating renewables and other kinds of variables like advanced storage technologies and things like that.
Holdman says the lab is unique in its ability to mimic an isolated or islanded grid, common in Alaska. She stresses that the lab does not rely on computer simulation, but uses real equipment to act out how generation systems will work in a specific community.
So you can take the data from a wind turbine in any community in the state. You can input it into our wind simulator, and it actually turns a motor generator system. So you actually have the wind turbine essentially turning in your lab, the power being generated as it would be in that community. And the same thing with the loads. You can program load events. So you can say, well, in this community, here's the average load that the community has, but you get spikes every now and then because somebody in the school turns on some equipment or something like that. So you can simulate and program the load bank to mimic a specific community.
Holdman says the Energy Lab is enabling the UAF Center to bring together and support diesel, wind, and hydrokinetic programs that have been scattered in various locations. She says the lab is very Alaska-focused, but its ability to verify performance of energy systems is drawing interest and contracts from outside Alaska.
For example, Boeing has been very interested in using our facility to test some of the products that they've developed for energy storage on what they work on as an islanded or a limited grid system, which is an airplane.
Holdman says many third world countries are dealing with similar energy challenges. The new $4 million UAF Energy Lab is the first component of a planned energy and power center expansion. The next phase is a $30 million office and small lab facility that would consolidate university energy research at one complex. The Center for Energy and Power is funded by government, tribal, and private entities. Since it deployed 6 years ago, the Missile Defense Agency's most powerful mobile radar has traveled across the Pacific, conducting flight tests and keeping an eye out for any ballistic missiles targeted at the United States. But while it's been to Seattle and Pearl Harbor, it's never made it to its home port of Adak, where a $26 million mooring for the radar lies unused. With the release of Missile Defense Agency's funding requests, it's looking even more unlikely that the radar will ever use that facility. According to Rick Lanier, the public affairs director with the agency, the sea-based X-band radar could see less use after it completes a number of flight checks this fall. Despite looking like a giant golf ball perched on top of an oil rig, the radar is one of the agency's most sensitive pieces of equipment. It spends at least 200 days at sea annually and costs $150 million to operate. Lanier says the agency would save money by using its smaller, more mobile X-band units. That doesn't mean that the radar will be fully retired.
People did have the impression that we were mothballing it or canceling it or dropping the SBX altogether, which is not the case. Mainly, it's just going to stay in one place for a longer period of time, but we'll still have it available if we need it for defensive operations and also for future flight tests.
But even though the radar won't be out to sea as much, it probably still won't be kept in Adak.
Yeah, I don't want to speculate. It never has yet because of its mission role in the Pacific, but you never know. I mean, we just don't know at this point in time, but more than likely it will be available for operations when necessary.
The maintenance of the 900 million radar in Adak was expected to help the village's economy, which took a hit after the Navy pulled out of its military base there in 2007. Right now, the radar is currently in operation in the South Pacific.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Rasmussen Foundation, accepting online nominations for the 2012 Distinguished Artist Award until March 1st. Learn more at rasmussen.org. Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net.
And by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
The Alaska Board of Fisheries addresses southeast finfish issues starting on Friday. Members will consider 145 proposals from advisory boards, gear groups, and individuals. They range from Sitka's Sacro herring harvest to Juneau's Taku River king sport fishery to changes in seine boat size limits. The meeting lasts 10 days. Fish and Game Board's director Monica Wellard says much of the first few days will be taken up by public testimony.
They'll be allowed that particular time frame to talk about the proposals they're for or against. And then there's also the written comments that they can provide, you know, put it all in writing and submit that during the meeting so their comments can be heard.
Other proposals involve sport fishing or freshwater kings, rules for reporting catches, and listing Haines Lutac Inlet as a subsistence management area. The Board of Fisheries is meeting at Ketchikan's Ted Ferry Civic Center. Audio will be streamed via the board's website. A program that brings books to kids across Alaska is accepting grant proposals. Best Beginnings is giving away funds to communities who want to start imagination libraries and expand existing ones. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has more.
Here's how it works. You sign up, and once a month, your child receives a great new book in the mail for free. There's no catch. It's that simple. Dolly Parton started the Imagination Libraries in her home state of Tennessee to increase literacy. Since then, it's spread to many other states and to several other countries. The program gives kids a book a month through the mail from birth through age 5. Barbara Brown is with Best Beginnings, the organization that helps set up the libraries in Alaska. She says the program is taking off.
Alaska, we found out this past summer, is the star of the show. We are growing faster than any of the other states and the Imagination Libraries.
So far, there are 27 local Imagination Libraries across Alaska, covering 80 communities. The first one was in Hoonah in 2003. The newest ones are in Togiak, Anchor Point, Copper River Valley, and Venati. Brown wants to keep that momentum going.
Alaska has 17,000 children signed up that get a book in the mail every month now, and that is one-third of the entire population of children under the age of 5 in the state of Alaska. We really are reaching out everywhere, and we want to get every village signed up and all their children enrolled.
If you want an Imagination Library in your community, Brown says it takes 5 committed people to apply for a grant.
If they can find 5 people to take on those 5 jobs, then I'm ready to work with them to set up an Imagination Library. So the jobs are things like somebody has to enroll the children, somebody has to put them in the database, someone has to work with the post office, and people have to do fundraising to try and contribute from their community to keep the program going.
Applications are also being accepted to expand existing Imagination Libraries. To learn more about Imagination Libraries, go to www.bestbeginnings.org. Applications must be received by 5 p.m. Friday, March 30th. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
In Alaskan winters, even waterfalls freeze. Once temperatures drop, those torrents of water in the canyons and gorges throughout our state turn solid. And as soon as they do, Alaskan climbers go out and hit the ice. Last Saturday, many of these climbers came together to participate in the Alaska Ice Climbing Festival. Reporter Shelby Carpenter dropped in on the action.
It's a relatively warm day along the Seward Highway, and despite Alaska's deep January freeze, the sun has melted part of the waterfall this group plans to climb. There are 4 climbers and 1 instructor, and having identified a safe portion of the mostly frozen waterfall, they begin to organize their gear for a day of climbing and learning. Their instructor, Matt Zundi, starts with the basics.
Real quick, physics. So, kilonewton. What's a kilonewton? 222 pounds dropped a meter, which happens to be like a convenient weight for like a climber with a lot of gear and a big lunch.
After the quick physics lesson, the climbers spend the morning practicing different ways to protect themselves if they fall.
Later on today, we're going to do mock leads where we're on the ice and going from the ground up. Everyone always asks, how did they get the rope up there? Well, this is how.
Standing at the base of the frozen falls is John Paul Griffin, a pilot in the Air Force and a relative newcomer to the sport. He only has 1 year of climbing under his belt, but he still signed up for this advanced class on learning how to lead climb.
I am about to pretend I am leading.
What's lead climbing?
Lead climbing is where you're kind of in on the sharp end of the rope and placing pieces of protection as you're climbing the rope.
John Paul starts climbing, and when he gets to the top, builds an anchor the way Matt taught him earlier this morning. He gets back down, and all the climbers take turns learning to lead climb. With a casual air, climber Marco Carter explains some of the downsides of ice climbing. One hazard is what climbers know as the screaming barfies, where blood flows back into your hands at the top of a climb, resulting in extreme pain and discomfort.
At times, I've had the screaming barfies, basically where you're on an ice climb and you have your hands above you and you're usually clenching your tools too hard. And then when you get to the top of the pitch, put your hands down, and it's just this horrible feeling, basically, when I barf and scream. But once you get after that 5-10 minute period where you're screaming, you feel really good, generally. Like, you're warm, and you notice, like, the sun's still shining, and, like, the birds are chirping.
Marco is no stranger to the risks involved in climbing. Just 18 months ago, he was rock climbing along this very highway when a boulder the size of a small compact car cleaved off in his hands. He fell 15 feet and thought he was fine, until he looked down and saw the compound fracture in his left leg. But still, he says, the rewards of climbing far outweigh the costs.
There is a lot of risk involved, but there's also the moments when everything is beautiful, and like those moments kind of rise above a lot of the danger and a lot of the cold miserableness.
Schlepping back to the van with their equipment, it's clear there's a confidence among the crew that may not have existed this morning. Each one is that much better prepared to go out into nature and to be safe while pushing their own limits. Along the Seward Highway, just north of Girdwood, I'm Shelby Carpenter.
Anchorage's Fur Rendezvous is set to begin tomorrow. The popular winter festival runs through March 4th. Events include the annual ice carving competition, and other events take place throughout the week. The Running of the Reindeer will be held downtown at 4 p.m. on Saturday, March 3rd. And finally tonight, we have a correction. Last night, in a story about Fort Wainwright 125th Stryker Brigade soldiers in Afghanistan, we reported that there had been 21 deaths in the battalion that should have been reported as total losses for the brigade. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Casey Kelly and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Alexandra Gutierrez in Unalaska, Daisha Eaton and Shelby Carpenter in Anchorage. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2012 PFD and consider sharing a portion of your dividend through Pick, Click, Give or contributing to a college savings plan. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska. 8 hours after you quit smoking, your blood oxygen level returns to normal. In 3 months, your lung function improves up to 30%. And 10 years after you quit, your risk of dying from lung cancer is about half that of a smoker. But right now, you're one cigarette closer to cancer. Every cigarette makes you sick. So quit smoking today.com. This 1-800-QUIT-NOW or AlaskaQuitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.